Can I just add, it's also good to see Angus here on his feet. if you don't know what I mean, ask him later what he's been doing. while I'm getting myself organised, you can turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. I printed in large print today too, so I don't need my glasses. all right, a familiar passage, Matthew chapter 5. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So Friday night, we watched a movie too, but probably not quite as deep a movie as that. I thought I'd introduce my kids, my two older ones at least, to The Truman Show. Do people know that movie? It's a movie where a man is living in a world and he discovers through the course of the movie that the world is not real and there's another whole world out there that he's yet to discover. And when Jesus sits down on this mountain to... This is the start of what they call the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus sits down to preach this sermon... He's declaring that he's got a whole new world to come. That what you see around you is not the world as it's meant to be. It's really interesting. If you think back to Deuteronomy, so if we go back into the Old Testament for a little bit, and think about when Israel is about to enter the Promised Land. Now, Israel has come out of Egypt. They've gone through the Red Sea, through the waters, spent some time in the wilderness, and they come to the edge of the Promised Land, and then they go up on the mountains, and Moses declares the blessings and the curses, the terms of the covenant that is to define the people that they are under God in the Promised Land. And this is exactly what Jesus is doing. And it's exactly how Matthew has designed his gospel. So if you go from the start of Matthew, after the birth of Jesus, you see that he's come out of Egypt. In Matthew 2:15, it talks about Jesus fulfilling the prophecy that out of Egypt I called my son. Then in chapters 3 and 4, he comes through the waters of baptism and out into the wilderness to be tempted. And then in the last half of chapter 4, he goes through parts of the Promised Land. And then in chapter 5, he sits down on the mountain and starts declaring the blessings, the terms of the covenant. Now, if you look in Luke's gospel, there's blessings and woes, but we're sitting in Matthew, which is just blessings. His kingdom is a good one. Just so we know what we're talking about, the word, when he says blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed, it means kind of happy, a mix of happy, satisfied, content, privileged, joyful. It's a really good word. It doesn't quite get captured by our English Bibles, but that's what it's talking about. So this morning we're gonna step through these and see how Jesus is declaring what his kingdom is like. He's declaring what his people are to be like. But we're also going to have a look at how Jesus himself fulfills these. He doesn't come and say, this is how I want you to live and I'm going to stay up here and watch you. He says, this is how I want you to live and this is how it looks. He doesn't ask us to do things that he doesn't do himself. Now we don't. Alright. So Matthew 5:3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So as we go through, I'm going to have a look at each of these, and we're going to have a look at, okay, what does this look like for Jesus, and what does this look like for us? And this one had me stumped at first. I thought, Jesus, poor in spirit? Come on, he knew who he was. He knew he was his father's son. There's no lack there. But as I meditated on this, I was drawn to John. And in John 5:19, this verse that we know very well says, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. That's Jesus, poor in spirit. He makes no assumptions about what it is he's meant to be doing or what it is that he's bringing. He's wholly dependent on his Father in heaven for what to do next. And in John 8:28, he says a similar thing. So Jesus said to them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak just as the Father taught me. That's Jesus, poor in spirit. And Paul picks up on this in Philippians when he says, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So what we can say is that being poor in spirit is really a posture of humility. Now, I think we've said this before, but we need to keep saying it. We're not talking about what we call worm theology. You know what I mean by worm theology? Oh God, I am just a worm. But in respectable evangelical circles, we would say it more like, I'm just a sinner saved by grace. But God doesn't look at us that way. He doesn't, look at Josh and say, hey, there's Josh. He's just a sinner saved by my grace. He looks at Josh and says, that's my son. But our humility is that we know that we bring nothing to the table. In some ways, it's the most offensive verse in the Bible, but also the most comforting. It's offensive because it means that everything that I have, all my knowledge, my skills, my money, my resources, my abilities, all of that, I can't impress God with that. It doesn't mean anything to him. He values it and he uses it, but it's not going to get me into the kingdom. I can't earn my way in. It's comforting because I don't have to have any of those things. I mean, you look at the people that Jesus called, mostly nobodies. I mean, Matthew, who wrote this gospel, was probably Matthew the tax collector, so he had money. But that didn't get him into the kingdom. He ended up giving half of it away. So we can take great comfort in that verse. Blessed are the poor in spirit, because we don't have to be anybody. We don't have to be skillful or like anybody else that we see that we admire. We just come as we are and say, God, I need you. That's what the Pharisees got wrong, right? They thought they had it, but they missed it. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, this is a weird verse. If you think about what it's actually saying, it's saying, happy are the unhappy, for they shall be comforted. And the word mourn there, it's the strongest Greek word for mourning. It's like when a loved one, someone that you deeply care about, has died. and you're mourning their loss. That's what it is. And when Jesus says this, it's the first point of recognition in this sermon that this new covenant that he's bringing, this new world he's drawing us into, that the old world, what we see around us, is not quite right. There is mourning in this world. You know, and what Jesus is bringing in his new world is in contrast to what we currently experience. In Matthew 23, it talks about Jesus mourning over Jerusalem. He says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones that are sent to it. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing." Can you hear Jesus' heart in that? He's mourning over his children. And I think there's a sense that you could say in Gethsemane, when he was praying to the Father before going to the cross, there was a sense of mourning there. You know, "Father, let this cup be taken from me." He knew the weight of sin that was going to be on his shoulders. And it deeply saddened him. Yeah, and for us, as we mourn and recognize that things are not right, we kind of walk this line between confidence in God's salvation and recognition of our own frailty and the things in us that are not right. You know, one of the things that I believe God calls us to mourn about is our own sin. James is very clear about this. He says, "Draw near to God and he'll draw near to you." We love that verse, but we don't very often read on. It says then, "Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you." Doesn't sound very Christian, does it? Mourn? Turn your joy to gloom? But you notice he doesn't stop there. He says, "Humble yourself and he will exalt you." There is joy there. But we've got to recognize our own shortcomings first. You know, and so we can mourn our own sin. There is a place as well for mourning others' sin. Not in a self-righteous way. That's not what we're called to, but in 2 Corinthians, Paul says to them, "I fear that when I come again, my God may humble me before you, and I may have to mourn over many of those who sinned earlier and have not repented of the impurity, sexual immorality, and sensuality that they have practiced." So Paul mourns over the Corinthians, and it's right for us to do that too, but it should be driving us to love and to pray for people, not to be self-righteous about it. And this comfort that Jesus talks about, he says those who mourn will be comforted. This is a core part of Jesus' mission. Do you remember that bit where he quotes Isaiah 61 when he goes into the temple and then he stops? Let me read this for you. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, and has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of God's favour and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes." I missed the line. "To grant to those who mourn in Zion, and the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit." So part of Jesus' mission is to bring an end to the mourning. So he's recognised that we do mourn, but I'm the one that will bring an end to it. And do you know, one of the descriptions of heaven, of what heaven is like, is that it's the place where God wipes away every tear. Isn't that a good description of heaven? He says, "Neither he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." So do you hear how Jesus, in saying, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted," is foreshadowing that His ultimate kingdom is coming, and there's going to be an end to this. So what you're mourning now, the pain that you're feeling about yourself or others or the world around you, that's not it. There is better things to come. Oh, sorry, wrong button. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now this one's really interesting. That word meek is not like the way we think about meek. It doesn't mean soft or able to be pushed out of the way. What that word means is bridled strength. It's strength that's there, but under control. The best example I could think of for this was, have you ever seen the movie of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, the Narnia movies? And you know that scene when Aslan, who's like the Christ figure, if you haven't seen it, and he's agreed to be the sacrifice for Edmund, to take his place, so that Edmund doesn't have to die. And so this is Aslan the Lion, the king of the whole world, powerful. And he goes willingly to where the forces of evil are, where they're going to sacrifice him. And he just walks in, and they mock him, and they hit him, and they do all sorts of things to him. And you know, this is the lion. He could take them out with one swipe of his paw or one bite of his mouth, and he does nothing because he knows what he's there for. That's meekness. Has all the strength in the world, and he doesn't use it against them. And it's really obvious to see how Jesus is meek, right? In Matthew, when he's about to be taken, he's just finished praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's about to be taken away to the to Pilate and the soldiers. Peter's just swiped off the ear of the soldier and Jesus has healed it. And what Jesus says to Peter, he says, "Do you not think that I can appeal to my Father and he will at once send more than 12 legions of angels?" So he knew that he didn't have to be there, but he chose to go willingly. That's the meekness of Jesus. You know, and for us, I think meekness will manifest most often, or has the opportunity to manifest most often in conflict. You know, I found it's really easy to take people down with our words, isn't it? But we don't have to. You know, when we have conflict with someone, we have a choice. Do we honour people and take the lower place and express the love of Jesus, or do we speak to their failings? Really very easy to see other people's failings, isn't it? Very easy to take them down, to exercise our power to destroy. But that's not what Jesus would have us do. You know, we need to realize, I guess, that we have nothing to prove. Often we're trying to prove something, right? But we've got nothing to prove. We've got the life of Jesus in us. We'd be better to redirect that strength that we have. Remember, right, not left. Towards God. The next one says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." Now this one's really alien to our culture, right? When do we often even think about what righteousness is, let alone hunger and thirst for it? Our whole culture is almost built around advertising, which speaks to us to hunger and thirst for all sorts of things. You know, in Jesus we see this hunger for God's righteousness when he drove out the money changers from the temple. He wasn't really concerned about anything other than than God's righteousness. You know, this is my Father's house, he said. How dare you? This is my Father's house. Do we care about the things that God cares about? You know, if we're honest, we hunger for lots of things. We hunger for money, sex, power, fame, comfort, happiness. But as Solomon discovered, those things don't satisfy, do they? They can make us happy for a little bit, but they leave us empty. Like, have you ever done this? Like, you've seen something, and you think, I want that, an object of some sort. And you pursue it, and you get it, and you realize that nothing's changed. That your life is just the same, just as ordinary as it always was. Exactly. It never ends. It never satisfies. I used to have this thing. It doesn't seem to happen anymore, but every time I would want something and buy something new, something would happen to stop me enjoying it at the first point. Either there'd be some sort of delay on the shipment, or it wouldn't work at first and I'd have to take it back, or it happened to me regularly. I looking back, I can see now that's God's mercy, that those things didn't become idols. But while, so Jesus could see the behavior in the temple and do something radical about that, right? He had that desire for God's righteousness. For us, it really, there's a very rare circumstance where we could do that, but more often we need to start here. Do we seek righteousness in our own temples, in our own bodies and minds? Are we behaving rightly in our homes and in our churches? And his promise is that if we seek after that, we will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. This is interesting too, because mercy means a couple of different things. I think there's an example from Jesus when the woman was caught in adultery in John 8, I think it is. And at the end he says, neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. He had mercy. But there's more than this. In Matthew 9:36, it says, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And then he did something. He fed them, or he healed them, or he drove out their demons. Mercy in the Bible is compassion in action. The word for compassion talks about being moved deep inside. It means that Jesus' heart felt for the people, like he felt their pain, he felt their lostness, and he wanted to do something about it. You could say he was stirred into action. And for us, that gets really simple, right? Mercy is you see a need and you do something. And it carries the sense that you do something not expecting to get anything back, particularly that you might show mercy in a place where the person is not able to give anything back. That's what mercy is. It's seeing that need and giving, and that's the end of it. You know, it says that those who show mercy will receive mercy. And I wonder, it doesn't talk about it in this sense in the Bible, but I wonder if that's what was happening in Acts. You know, when the early church was getting going, and it said that no one had any lack because they shared what they had. So I wonder if there's this cycle going on there. This is not straight out of scripture. This is just my thoughts. So take this and think about it. That someone has a need, someone has mercy and gives, and no one had any lack. There's this cycle that you've given, you've shown mercy, and you've received mercy, and no one was missing anything. verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now this is partly moral purity, but even more than that, it's talking about an undivided heart. So Jesus is drawing on some other scriptures here. So he's drawing on Psalm 24. It says, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully. He will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. And it's that last line that's the key there. It says that such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of... There's an active seeking of God. That's what it is to be pure in heart. It's the first and great commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength in some of the Gospels too. Now, let's jump back to where we started with Jesus doing what he saw the Father doing and listen to this in a different way. Because the blessing for those who are pure in heart is that they see God. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. See, Jesus was pure in heart. He had one, his heart was undivided. It was wholly for the Father. And so he saw the Father. He saw what God was doing and could partner with him. And if we want to partner with God and see what he's doing, our heart has to be just for him. It's kind of like when when you need to buy a new car, and you look around and you decide on the model that you want, then all of a sudden you start seeing that car everywhere. And that's what happens when we walk with God. When we make God our focus, you start seeing him everywhere. You see him in people and in nature and in the things that are happening around you, in your work, in your life. If your heart is pursuing something else, you won't see him because you're not looking. There's also a sense that being pure in heart means, is your heart the same when nobody's looking? You know, do we have the same heart at home with our family as we do on a Sunday morning at church when we're all smiles? Or do we do the Christian car park smile? Arguing all the way to church, and you get out the car, hi! Bless you! Let's not do that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Well, Jesus was the ultimate peacemaker, wasn't he? Colossians 1 says that for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And for us, when the Bible talks about peace and our role there, it talks about making peace with other people. So Romans 12:18 says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. And in Hebrews, strive for peace with everyone. Sometimes we are called, like Jesus reconciled and made peace between the world and God, we are called to make peace between other people. Happens to me at work sometimes in my role. We've got staff who have issues with one another, and I get to sit in the middle. It's a very unappreciated role. If you've ever had to help make peace between two people, you know that it's a thankless job. But just let me encourage you that that being a peacemaker is something that God sees. And even if the world doesn't thank you, he calls you his son. It doesn't go unnoticed in heaven. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, all these things we've been talking about, it's not the way the world really normally works, is it? And if you live this way, the world generally is not going to like you and thank you for it. Jesus, again, is recognizing here that although he's announcing his kingdom, the time is not yet for it to be fully manifested. So this is the already in the not yet kingdom, because he's saying this is how it is in the world, but the world's going to hate you for it. My authority is not yet being demonstrated through the whole world such that you will have an easy time of it. And, you know, Jesus obviously lived this, right? He, as we've seen, he lived this and he was persecuted to death and he was killed, right? But he said to us as well, he said, I've said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. And he also said, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they kept my word, they will also keep yours. So, I want to ask you a question. What did you hear as we walked through the Beatitudes? What did you hear in your heart? Do you hear a set of rules that say this is how we should live in God's kingdom? Did you hear a kind of measuring rod that tells you how you're doing? Am I being merciful enough? And there's some truth to those. There's an element that those things are right. But what it's really is what we've said before, that this is Jesus declaring that a new world order is beginning. He's saying that the world order that has been operating is on notice. The new king is here, the promised Messiah is here, and this is how it's meant to have been. This is how it was meant to be in the garden. And this is how it's going to be in the end. You notice as well that apart from the persecution at the end, all the Beatitudes are heart issues. They're all things that are deep inside. It's not what we're doing, though what we're doing comes out of that, but it's all issues of the heart. And you hear how countercultural the Beatitudes are. Might is no longer right. Injustice has no place in God's kingdom. Mercy rules. You can't buy, earn, or work your way in. Your only way in is to acknowledge that you have no way in. That's your qualification, is to acknowledge that you're not qualified. And joy, happiness, and blessings are its hallmarks. And it sounds idealistic, doesn't it, when we say it like that? And we've already said that it's in the future. It's not yet fully manifested. There is still mourning and persecution in this world. But just a little way on in the same sermon, Jesus tells us to pray that God's kingdom would come, that his will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. In other words, it is for now as well. It's fully in the future, but it's up to us to bring it now. I really like this quote from N.T. Wright, where he said that's the point of the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes in particular. They are a summons to live in the present in the way that will make sense in God's promised future, because the future has arrived in the present in Jesus of Nazareth. It may seem upside down, but we are called to believe with great daring that it is in fact the right way up. We don't see it as we look with our natural eyes in the world out there, but he calls us to believe it and to live it. So, I'd like to invite the worship team back up. And as they start playing, I just want you to close your eyes and see again, what do you hear? Do you hear the summons of Jesus to live like this? And what in particular is Jesus saying to you this morning? Do you hear Jesus calling you into this life of blessing? And is there some area of this where you could be experiencing more of his kingdom? It's our worship team. You know, perhaps as you look at your life, you realize that, yes, I could be more merciful. Perhaps I need more hunger for you, God. What is it that Jesus is saying to you this morning? You know, and we can't make ourselves do or be these things. We've already said that it's the poor in spirit who inherit the kingdom. We bring nothing. This is a work of the Spirit. So let's sing this last song and invite Jesus to speak into our hearts and show us what more we want of him.